This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm Tom Scragg. I'm here today with Professor Ian Morrison, a long-time academic based here at Jodrell Bank in Cheshire. Welcome.
Thank you.
Ian, you've been here a long time. When did you first come to Jodrell Bank?
As a research student in 1965, so I think I'm in my 52nd year or something like that. A long time.
What brought you here?
Well, I had an interest in astronomy probably from when I was about 11 or 12. I live right beside the sea, so it's quite dark. I had to wear some fairly thick glasses, as you can perhaps see. And little village, my father knew our local optician, Jimmy James, very well, and he actually gave me lenses with which I could make some very simple Galilean sort of type telescopes. And I do remember seeing the craters on the moon, and I think the moons of Jupiter, I'm not sure what else. But I did carry on my interest, because if I did win rarely the odd prize at school, they were all astronomy books, and I was able to study a little astronomy at Oxford. But I was also quite keen on radios. I used to make them when I was a kid, and I was in the Combined Cadet Force at school and set up the signals unit, playing with radios. And at Oxford, I was in the officer training corps and got a commission in the Royal Signals. I didn't really know what I was going to do when I finished my degree, but as I was going up the stairs to the library to do some revision, there was a little advert on the stairs saying, come and read radio astronomy at Jodrell Bank Observatory. Now, I liked astronomy. I liked radios. It seemed to fit quite well. And that's the story.
Oh, wow. Okay. Very fortuitous.
Absolutely.
So that's how you started. What are you doing these days?
Well, look, I've been retired for 5 years, but I'm coming in a couple of days a week to work with Professor Peter Wilkinson on something called MUST, the Manchester University Student Telescope. It's basically panels of arrays of Yagis, which we phase together to make a fairly large radio telescope operating about 600 megahertz. So I've been helping to commission that. But quite a long time ago, well, I suppose in the 80s and 90s, I used to build our Pulsar data acquisition hardware, design and build it. And I've always thought one ought to be able to detect a pulsar just using a computer to do all the hard work. And so I looked into this, and in fact I've designed a pulsar receiver based on what's called the Arduino Due, which is a little microcomputer board, lots of I.O., and that works perfectly. It won't work with particularly fast pulsars, but we have easily detected the one that Jocelyn Bell first detected over at Cambridge. So it does work, and that would be something for the students to use when they use the telescope.
That's very interesting, because one of the questions I get asked is, because I go to amateur astronomical societies myself, is how can amateurs get involved in radio astronomy?
Well, there are things you can do. I mean, you can easily detect the sun, and you can see sun flares on the sun. You can actually pick up some of the noise from the Jovian atmosphere as well. But the trouble is you tend to need relatively large arrays of telescopes. But the Pulsar little unit that I've designed, it can integrate for over an hour, and that might allow even a relatively small telescope to pick up a pulsar or two. With our 13-meter telescope here, which is quite big, I think we picked up the first one we tried in a matter of seconds. So there's a chance there anyway.
I'll pass that on to the people who keep asking. Okay, you're involved in the development of eMerlin.
Yes, well, I was one of the original designers of Merlin. That was way back in the late 70s, 80s. And I actually project managed the major enhancement to it in the late 80s, early 90s, which was great fun. So I have a real interest in it. And I'm hoping that we may be able to include one of the telescopes down at Gulhinnie Down. That would have two great advantages. It will actually increase the resolution of eMerlin, which is good, but it's more important than that. It will improve the image quality we get with sources that are lower down in declination, that's looking towards the south. If you look directly down on the UK from above, the telescopes sort of lie in a sort of an oval, which has a major axis east-west, Cambridge being at one end and Knockan at the other. You could imagine that painted out. That's our effective dish. Now, if you moved high up in the atmosphere, no, way above, moved down towards the equator, can you see, looking at that oval, it becomes narrower and narrower. And if we add in Goonhilly, then we have a much more southerly telescope. So the original telescope area we get is more circular. In fact, if anything, it's an oval north-south. So as you go further south, it doesn't become so elongated and narrow. Our image quality is better.
What are the chances of that happening?
Well, Janet is offering us a fiber optic link, and apparently they are bringing some of those telescopes back into use. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
Excellent. That'd be really good. Wasn't there some talk a couple of years ago about Ireland joining in with the Merlin?
There was. They did actually look into it, the possibility of building a 25-metre dish in Ireland, perhaps rather beautifully at Birr Castle, which of course was where a beautiful large optical telescope, the largest in the world, was built 2 centuries ago now. So we'll see. I think that's gone rather quiet, so I can't say anything more about it at the moment.
Okay, yes. I remember the initial excitement in the press, and then it has gone quiet. As well as all the radio astronomy then, you're a founding member of the Macclesfield Astronomical Society, so she's amateur optical astronomy, if I can call it that, and former president of the Society for Popular Astronomy.
Yes, that's a UK society, yes.
So by day a professional radio astronomer, and by night an amateur, if I may call you that.
Yes, absolutely.
An optical astronomer. Do you have any hobbies?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I do love amateur optical astronomy, and of course you'll see I've written some books about it, which hopefully will help other people to learn more about it. In fact, when I was 27, I had a 10-inch optical telescope, which in those days was actually quite a size for an amateur, and I've enjoyed going to parts of the world where there's very little light. In fact, we have a son that lives in South Island, New Zealand, which is one of the darkest places in the world. I've been there. I went to Kerry, which is a lovely dark sky site in Southern Ireland last year, and I've been to South Africa and other places. So I've really enjoyed seeing the night sky. In fact, when I went to South Africa, to a place called Sutherland, which is where the South Africans have built their large optical telescope called SALT, it was actually under construction. We're quite high up there. There was no moon, and I was just overwhelmed by the beauty of the southern sky. And I've loved going down to the south and imaging the heavens there. It's one of the nicest things I like doing. So I've really enjoyed astronomy, and it still makes a major part of my life. Having said that, I do have some other hobbies, I'm afraid. Well, I've always been very keen on photography. I've been in our local society for probably 30, 40 years now, and I was its president for some time. I used to do what you might call competitive photography, that is, you enter prints and pictures for competition. Having got very involved for about 5 years in astrophotography, I haven't done that much, but in fact, I've just recently entered some pictures for an exhibition, which I took on a photography trip to France last year. So that's a major one. And the last one is a bit sad, really. I rather do love narrow gauge railways, particularly as far and out of the way as possible. And I've been all over Europe to Romania, for example, to travel on some of these little railway lines. And I do have a little steam railway going around my back garden.
That's excellent. Any chance we can get a photograph to go on the podcast website, particularly of the trains in the back garden?
I can try and do that. Yes, I've just been balancing the track. So I was running trains for the first time this year, literally just a day or so ago. I'll try and do that.
Carrying on with both photography and amateur optical astronomy, then there's a lot of advances with digital cameras and softwares that seems to continue to keep happening.
It does.
So it's not just a step change, it's every year there are new developments. Is that what prompted you to produce your latest book?
Right, well, to put it into context, a couple of years ago, Cambridge University Press kindly published a book called An Amateur's Guide to Observing and Imaging the Heavens. And that was really to bridge the gap between the books for beginners, of which I wrote a couple all the way early 2000s, and there are many detailed books about individual topics. Springer Verlag published those. But there's nothing much in between. So this was a book about everything that I knew about amateur astronomy, both visual and photographic, but at a depth a bit deeper than the beginner's books, but not too bad, so even beginners could read it. And that actually sold very well and it's got some very nice reviews. However, having done that, I had done more work in astrophotography. In particular, I wrote a whole series of articles for Astronomy Now for beginners. And it seemed quite a nice idea to write a book based upon those essentially, apart from about four chapters about specific things to help all aspects of astrophotography, it was done in the form of little projects. This is a nice thing to do. What equipment do you need? How do you go out and take the pictures to do it, or the images? And then in particular, how you process them to give you a really nice image that you can be proud of. And so it starts off with just using a digital camera and a tripod, and there's a rather nice Star Trails image that's actually on the front of the book that I took, in fact not far from here, a little mirror called Reed's Mirror, not far from Jodrell. And it gradually advances to more, you know, complicated bits of equipment. So it covers almost everything, again, hopefully, in a very accessible way. So that's the plan. So that's been quite fun, and I've enjoyed writing that. That was published, it came out just a month or so ago. Haven't seen any reviews yet. One thing I could say, which might indicate it could be of some use, is that about a year and a half ago, a colleague of mine, who was a very good nature photographer, had some very nice lenses, asked me how he could image the Orion Nebula, which is a lovely region, but actually it's a very tricky thing to image, because there's an incredible brightness range between the central part around the trapezium stars and the outer nebulosity. So a lot of pictures burn out the inner part. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I told him what I thought he should do and how he should process it. He did that. He produced an image which, if anything, is better than the one I produced. He put it into the annual astrophotography competition run by the Royal Observatory, and he won the beginners. It was, in fact, the Sir Patrick Moore Beginner's Prize for astrophotography. So maybe my advice can't be too bad.
Well, excellent. I mean, I've got both of your recent books, and they're beautifully produced and very clear and wonderful guides to what to do.
Oh, well, I'm glad you say so. Thank you very much.
While we're on the subject of books, how about a guide to radio astronomy?
Well, that's interesting. Early 2000, 2001 and 2002, I co-wrote, I think I probably wrote most of it, a distance learning course which was called Observing the Radio Universe, which was studied by hundreds of students over about 7 or 8 years. And in fact, I looked after the final group of students from the Open University who were doing it. And I put that to Cambridge University Press then, saying this might be the basis of quite a nice book. You know, not too detailed, but it gives you a nice coverage of what radio astronomers do and how we do it. And they came back and said they didn't really think there'd be enough interest. Well, I have to say that Professor Graham Smith has written a book that Oxford University Press published recently, and so there must be some interest, and maybe I should try again. That particular course, or the book based on it, you might say, is being used by students in South Africa who are beginning to prepare for the Square Kilometre Array. They're trying to teach people, you know, about...
Yes.
In fact, they also use a PDF copy, which is free on the web, I shouldn't say, of the textbook I wrote on, it's called An Introduction to Astronomy and Cosmology, when I gave the course at Manchester for 6 years. And in fact, that's still selling very well. I'm amazed. That's been quite good for me. And anyway, they've all got copies of that, and they're learning a bit about astronomy and radio astronomy that way.
Amazing. I mean, I'm going out to Africa as part of that program myself in a couple of weeks, so maybe I
should get a
coffee, please.
You may come across them anyway.
Have a read before I go. As well as the books and the periodicals and the contributions to magazines, you've now got an online blog.
Yes, I'm never very keen on the word blog, so I called it an astronomy digest. And I only started it in December, and I think there are now something like 12 individual essays, or pages, in fact, WordPress called them. I started that for two reasons. One is to basically provide articles that could be of interest to all amateur astronomers. In fact, there are three articles giving everything I know about refractors, which are lovely instruments, and I have several, and they're the most beautiful optical instruments. They can be near perfect, which is what I really like about them, and I've got one or two really beautiful ones. So that's of interest. Secondly, to try and update some of the books. Now, in between the two astronomy books, amateur astronomy books that CUP published, they also published a book based upon my lectures as Gresham Professor of Astronomy in London. That was one of the nicest things that happened to me way back in 2007. I was appointed to the Gresham Chair of Astronomy, which is the oldest in the world and once held by Christopher Wren, apparently, which is amazing. And I gave lectures in London. And basically, versions of those lectures we have put into book form. Now, that came out, I think, late 2014. And there's one thing that's happened since then that certainly couldn't be in the book, although I foretold it, and that was the direct detection of gravitational waves by LIGO, as I'm sure all our listeners know about. So one essay in this digest is literally the last bit of that chapter, shall we say, adding to what's really happened now. So that's another reason. So that's all been quite fun. And I quite enjoyed doing that. And every so often, new bits of equipment appear, and I can write about those. So it's to keep those books up to date, but hopefully it'll be of interest to anybody. And there's a link to it on the Night Sky page. Or if you put Astronomy Digest in, it seems to come up fairly high on Google now. It's gradually worked its way up from about page 3. It's now near the top of page 1. So maybe someone's looking at it.
Well, hopefully. Have you a space for reader feedback? Or
We may try and do that. To be honest, my son's in IT and he set it up for me.
Right.
And that's something which we haven't got yet. But it would be nice to get feedback because I've got no idea if anybody's reading it or if it's any good. So that would be nice.
Okay. Ian, you have an asteroid named after you by the International Astronomical Union. So I'm actually officially named a body.
Yes, it's Ian Morrison without one. There's no. It's just one word. It's only about 8 kilometres across, so it's quite small. But quite amazing, I wasn't expecting it at all. Apparently it was awarded, I think, in September 2003. It then goes on a website. Of course, it's not a website I look at, so I never knew. But there's a rather nice bit of I suppose it's vellum. Anyway, one of these nice bits of things that they beautifully inscribe all the reasons for doing it and so on. And that actually was sent to me by post to open on my 60th birthday. And the only sad thing was it sort of upstaged any of the other presents I got for my 60th birthday, including a very nice painting that my wife had bought me. So that was really quite exciting. It's not really deserved. It was for my work at Jodrell on Merlin, but also in terms of what's called Project Phoenix, which has probably been the most sensitive search ever for signals from ET over 5 years. We looked at 230, I think, of the nearest sun-like star systems, some of which we now know have got planets. But of course, we didn't pick up any signals. But maybe I'll come back to that later.
The assumption with SETI, since we've moved slightly onto that subject, is always that radio will be the communications method, whether it's deliberate signals from another civilization, or it's leakage, or it's some other way of detecting a remote intelligence. Have you any thoughts on that?
Well, it doesn't have to be radio. The people at Harvard University have been looking for very, very short duration optical pulses, because theoretically you could build a laser system that for a few trillionths of a second can actually outshine the star that's nearby. And hence you could pick that up with the special detectors. So far, nothing's been found. I do have a worry with SETI. I give a talk about it fairly often. Are we alone? ? I'm pretty convinced that simple life forms will be very widespread. But it took a very long time on the Earth for simple single-cellular life forms to become multicellular, which is obviously necessary for them to evolve into things like us. And then it took a very, very long time for that to happen. So there were two long periods, 2 billion years, I think, from single to multicellular, and similar since then. And I'm not convinced that many planets will remain sufficiently stable in their temperature to allow such a thing to happen. And it may well be that our large moon, which may or may not be very common relative to a planet, is important. It's certainly stabilized our rotation axis and the various other things as well. So my honest opinion at the moment is that I think that we are probably the only advanced civilization in our galaxy. Now, there could be some in the future. In fact, if our civilization died out because we did something terrible to ourselves, things could evolve again into a future one. We've got a couple of thousand million years. One problem, though, is that the sun's getting hotter.
Okay.
And so in about 1,000 million years, I think it might be too hot on the surface for life, but that's another matter. So I'm not convinced that SETI will actually ever give us any results. It'd be exciting if it did, but I do think that we may have a chance of detecting the presence of simple life forms either in our own solar system, Mars, Europa, Enceladus are three possibilities, or by observing the atmospheres of nearby exoplanets, detecting the presence of ozone, which must be there only if there's free oxygen, and that will disappear very rapidly unless it's being replenished, and of course on the Earth that's done by photosynthesis in plants. So we might get a hint that there's some life on other planets as well.
That's based on absorption spectroscopy?
Yes, it is. In the IR, in the infrared. And in fact, if you look at the atmosphere of our spectrum compared to, say, Mars and Venus, both of which show carbon dioxide, our spectrum is far more complicated. There are bands due to water vapour, which obviously is good for life, a bit of methane, but particularly there's a big band of ozone, or an absorption line in ozone, which you can pick up in the infrared. So that's a chance there.
It's a very exciting time, especially in astronomy.
Yes.
Especially for us that have an interest and are involved. But what would you say was the most exciting development in astronomy in the UK, for example?
Well, that's a hard one. Well, in the radio, I think it's got to be the discovery of quasars and learning about the way that they must produce their energy, because one of them, 3C273, I can even observe with my 12-inch telescope in my back garden. It's a very long way. It's 2,500 million light years away. So can you see there's got to be a lot of energy there? And we're pretty certain now that's caused by matter in falling onto a black hole. And rather nicely, way back in 77, I think it was, I helped discover the position of what we think is the nearest black hole to our Earth. It's Nostris X1. It was discovered originally as an X-ray flare, but the X-ray telescopes in those days didn't really know where things were very well. And happily, using a phase table interferometer that I've been using with my student, we were able to locate its precise position. You can tell that there is a K2 type star, which is a bit less massive than our own Sun, about 0.8 solar masses maximum. You can see it's going around something else. They're co-rotating with an object you can't see. And on the back of the envelope, you can show that the total mass is about 10 and a bit solar masses. If you take off the 0.8, the thing that's going around must be about 9. And if it was a star, you'd see it. And we don't, so it's a black hole. It's well above the mass that you need to make a black hole. So I think all that's been interesting. And I think the other work that we've done here, and we've done some lovely things at Joshua, the double pulsar is a way of not directly but indirectly showing the presence of gravitational waves. That's been great. And I think all the work on gravitational lensing that was done here, we discovered the first lens way back in the 70s. So there've been I think Joshua actually has played quite a nice role. I'm sure there are many, many other things, but that's enough to be going on with.
What would you say would be the greatest challenge for astronomy in the UK in the coming years?
Challenge? Well, providing enough funding. I mean, a slight worry about Brexit is that Jodrell Bank gets a fair bit of its income from the European Union. I think it's guaranteed by our own government till 2020, but let's hope that continues afterwards. Because I think Merlin and the Lovell telescope are still playing a major role in radio astronomy. I mean, look, the Lovell telescope is now very old, but it's been rebuilt about twice. And I promise you, hand on heart, it is now better in every way than it ever has been. The receivers we have now are vastly better than we had when it began. The surface is more smooth, and we drive the telescope around the sky more accurately. So it's still a front-rank instrument. It helps Merlin when it's employed in Merlin, but also it is a pivotal role in what we might call the European array, the European VLBI network officially, that stretches across Europe. And that's the highest resolution instrument of any in the world. You cannot do better than what the EVLA does. And we can actually observe the expansion of the supernova remnant in a galaxy 12.5 million light years away. So there's some very nice things going on, and I just hope they can continue. And it's great that we have our links here with the Square Kilometre Array. As I drive into Jodrell now, every time I do it, things are different. Roads are changing, trees are going down, and the new building for the SKA is going to be coming up quite shortly. So that's exciting. And another thing I think about the future of radio astronomy is that whenever you've had, or even optical astronomy, whenever you've had an instrument with vastly greater capabilities than anything that's gone before, you tend to discover things that you didn't even know existed. Donald Rumsfeld, the unknown unknowns. And let's hope that when the SKA comes online, perhaps 2026, that we'll begin to discover things that we have absolutely no knowledge about or inkling of at the present.
That's always the question. We know so much. Why do we keep studying? Or why do we keep spending money on research? But you've no idea what you don't know.
Exactly.
And that's the area to explore always.
Yes.
Just to wrap up the interview, yeah. Is there anything you want to say to our listeners? I mean, we have quite an audience for the Jodcast.
No, it's amazing, and thank you for listening. I hope you do find the night sky audio interesting. It was rather wonderful. I gave a lecture at the Birmingham Science Festival a couple of years ago, and somebody came up to me who I didn't recognise and said, "It's great to see the face behind the voice." It was actually Guy Cosmologica, I can't pronounce it very well, the Pope's astronomer. And he'd obviously enjoyed listening to the Jodcast. Whether it was any use to him, I don't know. But I mean, I knew that it was picked up by, you know, across the world. I didn't know it went quite as high up as the Pope, so I was really quite impressed with that.
Professor Ian Morrison, thank you for your time today. It's been wonderful chatting.
Thank you very much.